From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. A couple of rock and roll greats on this edition of Fresh Air. Benny King sang lead with the Drifters in the late 1950s. Then in 1961, King really hit it big, writing and singing one of rock's memorable ballads, Stand By Me. Benny King reviews his career on our show today. Also today, Ronnie Spector remembers what it was like to lead one of the most popular girl groups of the 1960s, the Ronettes. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead gives his picks for the 10 best albums of 1988, and television critic David Bianculli reviews the Karen Carpenter story, a made-for-TV movie about the pop singer's life and death. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Benny King sang lead with the Drifters from 1958 to 1960. As soon as he left the Drifters, he started a solo career. His biggest hit was a song he wrote.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me, stand by me.
Stand By Me made it to number 4 on the charts in 1961. 25 years later, Stand By Me was used as the theme for the film of the same name. The record was re-released and landed back in the top 10. Other Benny King solo hits include Spanish Harlem, Don't Play That Song, and I Who Have Nothing. With the Drifters, he recorded There Goes My Baby, This Magic Moment, Save the Last Dance for Me, and I Count the Tears. Before Benny King ever sang on stage or in the recording studio, he sang with his friends on the streets of Harlem.
I was born in Henderson, North Carolina, so I wasn't familiar with the street singing thing until I came to New York, which I was about 11 years old when my parents first moved to New York. And I heard about it, and then gradually, by being in the streets of Harlem, I walked around and, surely enough, bumped into different little guys singing and doo-wopping on the stoops and stuff like that. So I was more or less introduced to it when I first got to New York.
Did singing in a vocal group on the streets give you the same kind of security as belonging to a gang?
Yeah. Well, it gave me I would imagine a means of communicating with other people, because I was a very shy person when I first got to New York. I guess just the fear of New York itself made me that way. It gave me a chance to meet nice people, nice guys to hang out with, kind of. And it was the alternative to other type of gangs. We had gangs during our time as well, but I fortunately for myself, I bumped into, I think, the right kind of people, you know.
Now, you also sang, before you started recording, you sang at Amateur Night at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. Did you all have matching suits in your group?
Yeah, we had, what did we have? We had pink jackets.
Oh, great.
I know, right? That's what I said. Pink jackets and black shirt and black trousers. I mean, it was a sight to behold that. Yeah.
Did you save up for the suits?
Yeah, we did. What happened was that our parents gave us some money for it, because we were all, like, in school, you know, so our parents gave us money to go and buy these little uniform jackets and stuff, and we just found our own black trousers and stuff, yeah.
Did you have a choreographer also?
Not as such. What we had done, though, because I lived 116th Street and 8th Avenue, which was only maybe a few blocks from the Apollo itself, which was, Apollo was 125th. So really, I would go to the Apollo a lot. We all did, you know, and see all the other groups and just learn the things that they were doing and practice it in the streets and stuff like that. So we more or less had our own little routine, just taking it from different groups that was already professionals.
Which was the hottest group at the time that you really tried to emulate?
I would imagine, like, the Flamingos and the spaniels, the clovers, the platters, people like that, you know. And like I say, we had a chance to go up to the Apollo and see them and, like, learn things from them.
That's great. Singer Benny King is my guest. Now, you sang with the Crowns.
Yeah.
The Five Crowns. And you sang bass before you started singing lead. Can your voice still go that low?
I think so. Yeah, Kent, I'm naturally a bass baritone. I guess that's my voice tend to go very heavy. I'm naturally a bass baritone, so I can sing bass still, I think, yeah.
Did it have a certain prestige to be the bass man in a vocal group?
Well, girls always thought so. Girls like the bass singer, I guess, because he had that more mature depth to his voice. And they tend to howl around. And at that time, you have to realize that most of the bass things were done in the doo-wop groups and stuff like that was the featured thing in the song, you know. So the bass singer was the one that was doing the doo-doo-wop-a-doo-doo-wop-a-doo-doo-wop-a-doo-doo, all that stuff, see? So you couldn't go wrong with that, you know. So I had the chance to do all those things, and the girls was just standing around and giggle and stuff. So I think that was, you know, one of the key things that helped me as far as getting me introduced to the females there.
Oh, that's great. Well, you went from bass singer with the Crowns to lead singer with the Drifters.
Yeah.
And before I ask you to tell us a story about how the Crowns became the new Drifters and how you got to sing lead, I want to play the first song that you recorded singing lead as the lead singer of the Drifters. And
okay.
This is There Goes My Baby.
Oh, oh. There she goes. There she goes.
Benny King singing lead with the Drifters on There Goes My Baby. So tell us how the Crowns, who you sang with, became the Drifters.
Well, that's one of those strange stories, really. I joined the Crowns because the guy that was managing them by the name of Lover Patterson lived across the street from my father's restaurant. So he came in one day and asked me to join the Crowns. He brought them into the store, and we rehearsed in the back of my father's restaurant, and I became a member. And the Crowns were, I would imagine, a very good, like, vocal type group, semi-pro. And we opened up at the Apollo with Ray Charles, and I think it was Faye Adams on the bill, and of course the Drifters were on the bill as well, and we were the opening act. During that week, we were approached by their manager, George Treadwell, and he had mentioned to us that he had been watching us, and he thought we were a very good group, and would we be interested in becoming a new set of Drifters.
He had just, fired Clyde McFadder, who had been the lead singer.
Yeah, well, what had happened in that, I think Clyde really wasn't in the group at that time. Clyde had more or less gone solo, but the other members were in the group. And he had, I guess, had problems with the group, or the group had problems with him. And they decided to just split company, and they did so, you know.
Right, so Clyde McFadder had left the group, and then the producer fired the rest of the
fired
Drifters.
The rest
That's
of
the way
group.
It went,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And when the producer decided that your group would be the next Drifters, did they do anything different with you or tell you to do anything different for you to become Drifters?
Not really. I think that was the strange thing about the whole situation is that when we became a new set of Drifters, there weren't any instructions at all given to us. You know, we used to go on the road as the new set of Drifters before the record was released, and we were booed off the stage, and we had bottles thrown at us and chairs and the whole nine yards. So we weren't given any warning to what to do, how to act. We got uniforms, and I think we got a new station wagon or something like that. But that's the only thing that we received as far as become a new set of Drifters, as well as the fact that we had to fulfill the Drifters' recording contracts, and we weren't aware of that. You know, we were just four or five kids coming out of Harlem, From a very, very amateurish background, even during the time with the Five Crowns, we were just more or less, as I said before, semi-pro. So we didn't know about all the particulars that professionals would go through to more or less make a living in the business.
You got booed because the fans were expecting the other Drifters, and yeah, here you exactly. were with no explanation.
That's right, exactly. Well, it's like going to see the four. I always say it's like going to see the Four Tops, and all of a sudden the curtain opens, and there's four guys about 17 years old. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you would face. Yeah.
Now, when you were telling us about the Crowns, you had sung bass with the Crowns, but you ended up singing lead when the Crowns became the Drifters.
Yeah.
How did you get to sing lead?
I wrote the song "There Goes My Baby," while we was on the road, and when I got back to New York, I showed it to Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who produced today. And while we were in the studio, I was trying to show the lyrics to Charlie Thomas, who was the lead and did all the tenors to the songs. And for some strange reason, he couldn't get the feel of the song. And Jerry Wexler, who was involved with the date as well, came into the control room and said, "Look, Charlie's having trouble with this song. You sing it, you know." And I just went to the mic. I had an advantage over him because I had written the song anyway. So I went to the microphone and started singing, and I was stuck with lead since then.
Stuck, huh?
Yeah, stuck, right?
A lot of the Drifters records had strings
on it,
and they really sound great, and I think they were probably the first or among the first
right.
R&B records to have strings on it. Did you go for that idea originally?
Oh, no, that had nothing to do with me. Again, like I said, I was just more or less along for the ride. I wasn't familiar with what went on in the studio. That was my very first time in a really professional studio when we went into the Atlantic Record Studio as the Drifters. I didn't know that strings and kettle drums and cellos and all those pretty instruments weren't the norm for anyone that was going into the Atlantic Studios. I didn't know that we were making history at that time. That was an idea brought up by Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who was brave enough to make that move and change the whole musical history of rock and roll.
Well, I want to play another song that you recorded with the Drifters, and this is, of course, you're singing lead on it. This is a song that made it to number one both on the R&B charts and on the pop charts, which was a pretty big deal. Really.
Right. No, that was a great deal during that time, because in that time you have to allow for the fact that they weren't actually playing a lot of black records. And not only weren't they playing a lot of them, they weren't even thinking about crossing them over.
Do you want to say anything else about Save the Last Dance for Me before we hear it?
To say the Last Dance still is one of my favorite songs. I re-recorded it recently in an album that I just did not too long ago.
Let's hear your first version of it.
Okay.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye to let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand beneath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Oh, I know that the music's
yes,
fine like sparkling wine. Go and have your
yes,
fun.
Oh, I know.
Laugh and sing.
Yes, I know.
But while we're apart,
oh,
don't give your
yes,
heart to anyone.
Oh,
but don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Baby, don't you know I love you so? Can't you feel it when we touch?
Well, that still sounds very terrific.
Thank you.
When you found out that you were going to be a lead singer, did that give a new push to your career? Had you been thinking that you weren't going to make it as a backup singer?
Not really. I didn't think about making it as a singer anyhow. I was doing what I was doing to enjoy my life. I didn't pursue a career in show business. I didn't know that you could have a career in show business. I thought that everybody was singing to have fun, not to earn a living, not to anticipate stardom. I still find it fascinating that so much money goes around in this business. I didn't actually start off to be a singer aiming at any particular careers or aiming at any particular spot in life. I just enjoyed music, which I still do very much.
I never got to see the Drifters perform. in the early 60s. And I was wondering, we were talking a little bit earlier about choreography.
Yeah.
Did you have a lot of choreography in your act?
Not a lot. We did, there are steps that I call short steps, and short steps are done like by groups like Platters and Drifters, and then the fast wide steps are done like Gladys Knight and the Pips and Temptations do wide and fast. And there was the Olympics, a group called the Olympics. They do fast movements and fast steps. We do little short, cute things, you know, things that don't require a lot of sweating and falling down. I'd never learned how to do the split and stuff like that. You know, I left all that stuff out. I don't know that. I don't know nothing about doing the split. I could never get into that. Yeah.
You never took off your jacket and threw it into the audience?
I did that.
Did
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I did that. Those things was great. That was easy, you know, and throwing your handkerchief away and stuff. I did those brave things, you know.
I used to love that at the rock and roll shows.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah, did that.
A lot of fun, that.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk with you about how you started your solo career, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is singer Benny King, who started to sing professionally in the early 60s as the lead singer with the Drifters, recording hits like There Goes My Baby and Save the Last Dance for Me. And in his solo career, he recorded Stand By Me, Spanish Harlem, I Who Have Nothing, and other records as well. And we'll hear some of them, talk more about his music after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Singer Benny King is my guest. You know what I'd like to do? I want to ask you about how you started to perform solo. So why don't I play some of the record that launched your solo career?
Okay.
And this is Spanish Harlem. Benny King, would you explain how you left the Drifters and started singing solo?
Well, what happened in that is that once we got involved with all the recordings and we had all the hit records that we had once we started with the Drifters situation, we were on salary as the new set of Drifters, and we were making like maybe $100 a week or somewhere in that neighborhood. And we were all more or less trying to make ends meet, because that $100 would have to keep us alive on the road, and of course tried to send some money home. So we, in other words, to make a long story short, we had managerial problems, and I along with Charlie Thomas, Doc Green, and Ellsbury Harp, we had discussed trying to go to George Treadwell and ask for a raise. And this is a group with a number one record.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got to the office, we had set up a meeting, we got to the office to discuss this problem that we were having as far as salary. He told me, instead of me standing up to speak for the group, to speak for yourself, and I did so, and he fired me. he was great at firing people, and I walked out of the office assuming that the other guys would follow, and they didn't. The only guy that followed me was the same one that came across the street to my father's restaurant and convinced me to join the Five Crowns, who was Lover Patterson, and it was his determination and his, feeling that I had something in my voice that should keep on. He insisted that I stayed in the business, and he was the one still I find very responsible for me still being here now. You know, I hold him very near and dear. He's long passed away for many years now, but to answer your story, he's the reason why I more or less stayed and started a solo career. The record that you just played recently was Spanish Harlem. was originally supposed to have been a Drifter record. And although I was out of the group, Atlantic, which a lot of companies at that time was doing that, they would call the lead singer back in the group to, and pay him scale just to keep the sound in the group. So they were doing that to me as well. That's why the, if you look at my recording world, the things that go on with me as far as a recording artist, you'll find that I left the group in 1960, but yet and still I recorded a record with the group in 1962, and yet and still I had my own solo career started in 1961. It's very crazy, all that. That's because Atlantic would ask me to come back and to do some Drifter recordings and just pay me scale. So I...
But did you think of Spanish Harlem as a solo record or a Drifter
record? No. Now, to get back to that problem, that what happened that, it should have been a Drifter record. Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, who at that time we had developed a very strong friendship as writers and producers and friends, and they're the ones that went to Atlantic and spoke to Ahmet Erdogan and asked him would he consider a Spanish Harlem being a Benny King record opposed to a Drifter record, and that's how I started a solo career with that record there, really.
Now, you also recorded Stand By Me as a solo record. Now, you wrote that record.
Yeah.
You wrote, and someone named Elmo Glick gets co-writing credits. Did he co-write it with you, or was that
Elmo
someone who just...
Glick was a silent partner for years. Elmo Glick is the pen name, I found this out maybe 4 or 5 years ago, of Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller.
Oh, no.
Those were my ghost writers, and I didn't know it for many, many years. So just go to show you, right? Yeah. But yeah, as I said earlier, you know, we were just kids out of Harlem with no knowledge at all about legalities and what should happen and what shouldn't happen in this business. And I'm only one out of hundreds and thousands of the artists that got those things happened to, you know. So
well, a lot of artists were deprived altogether of writing credits. So
gotcha.
So I guess in some respects,
I was lucky. I'm one of the lucky ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm one of the lucky ones.
I want to play one of your solo records that I think is one of the most dramatic sounding pop songs I know. And this is I Who Have Nothing. And this is really high drama. I love this record. as everyone will hear, there are great pauses in this record. And when you come on, there's like timpani behind you.
Mm.
Were the pauses written in? Did you decide how long to pause? Did you know the timpani was going to come in with you?
Some of the things I would rehearse with Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, but that was just three guys around a piano. So most of the performing things that was done on the records was just the way I felt at that time. I'm not one of those regimented type recording persons where I know exactly what to do at each particular time in a song. I just close my eyes and go for it. Yeah.
Well, let's hear it. This is Benny King singing I Who Have Nothing.
I who have nothing, I who am no one, adore you and want your soul. I'm just a no one with nothing to give you but he buys you diamonds, bright, sparkling diamonds. But believe me, dear, when I say that he can give you the world, but he'll never love you the way I love you.
It breaks me up every time I hear that. Were you as emotionally involved in that recording as you sound?
Yes. I think what happened in that is that my manager and I, to make a long story short, my manager and I, at the time, his name is Al Weil, we were traveling over to Europe to get myself established over in the European market. And we got up one night while we were in Rome, and he had found this songwriter, and we went by this office. And this guy, he was Italian, of course, and he was speaking in Italian. He was playing Italian songs, but he played this one particular song, and my manager and I picked it up right then and there and said, this is a hit record. The guy who was singing in Italian had the same kind of deliverance and the same kind of feeling about the song. I didn't know what the words were saying, but I know the feeling was great. When I got home and we showed it to Jerry Lieber and Mike Stolen, they wrote the English lyrics to it. We knew that the song was great. I think that during that time when I was singing songs, I got very, very involved with it. The whole feel of the song. It's amazing when you grow older, your attitude changes, and you tend to not be as involved and not as, you don't throw your whole self into songs. I listened to myself when I was singing years ago, and I prefer my performance much more than I do today. And I did that with a feeling. When I was doing I Have Nothing, I tried to, at that time, compliment a song as a songwriter would have meant it to be.
Just a couple of years ago, when the movie Stand By Me was released, your record was re-released as well and ended up back on the charts, a big hit all over again.
Yeah.
How did that affect your career? What were you doing before the film, and was that changed after?
Before the film, I was traveling in Europe a lot. I was still recording. What else before the film? Before the film, I was more or less working. I was doing quite a lot of work. It's triple, if not more so than triple, since the movie, of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was a period when you were touring with a group of the Drifters.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a remake, a reconstituted version of the Drifters. And
right.
I think there were two different Drifters groups at the same time.
I cannot begin to tell you how many different groups of Drifters there are. I know myself there's about a half a dozen.
Still performing?
Sure, they're doing great, too. I mean, doing booming business, you know. I'm the only one, I would imagine, other than Clyde, that have actually never gotten back into the group or formed his own set of Drifters kind of thing, you know. I occasionally get back with the guys and do a song or so, you know, and do a couple of shows or whatever. I joined Johnny Moore. Johnny Moore has a group of Drifters in Europe, and they're very, very popular. They're one of the hottest groups in all of Europe. I joined them, I think, in 82 to 83, off and on, flying to Europe and back home to do a Benny King Drifter-type tour. And that's, you know, that was great, but that he's just only one member. Then they have Charlie Thomas Drifters and Bill Pinkney Drifters. And if you were a member, you could have your Drifters.
Okay, well, I love your singing, and I thank you so very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Benny King's latest album is called Save the Last Dance for Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, playwright and actor Harvey Fierstein. He's turned his hit Broadway play, Torch Song Trilogy, into a film. It's the story of a gay man and his relationships with his lovers and his mother. The success on Broadway of this semi-autobiographical play was a landmark in gay theater. I hope you can join us. From Benny King's latest album, this is Two Lovers.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the 1960s, Ronnie Spector sang lead on what's been called the perfect pop record, the Ronettes' Be My Baby. Ronnie Spector also married super producer Phil Spector. At his insistence, she stopped singing. Ronnie's singing and recording again, and coming up, we meet Ronnie Spector. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead looks back on 1988 and gives his choices for the 10 best albums of the year. And television critic David Bianculli reviews a new made-for-TV movie based on the life and death of singer Karen Carpenter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. A flurry of diplomatic activity is reported in Israel today following reports over the weekend that Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak might visit Israel for the first time since taking power 8 years ago. Details from NPR's John Hockenberry.
This morning, Yitzhak Shamir's aides were describing his peace plan loosely as a set of ideas which could contribute to peace. According to one Shamir aide, it would be unveiled before Shamir goes to Washington in February. Egypt appears to be the impetus for today's diplomatic activity. Sources in the Prime Minister's office said tonight that when Egypt's President Mubarak said over the weekend he would be happy to go to Israel, Shamir decided to go public with his peace plan still in preparation. There have been contacts today between Israeli and Egyptian officials in Jerusalem and Cairo. In his first meeting with a foreign envoy, newly installed Israeli Foreign Minister Moshe Arens met with the Egyptian ambassador. Israel described the talks today as intensive, but Egyptian sources characterized them as routine. Israeli officials say they expect to know if a meeting between Shamir and Mubarak can take place before the week is out. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
A Palestinian terrorist group says two French girls held hostage for more than a year are now on their way to Paris. The Fatah Revolutionary Council says it released the girls as a Christmas present to the children of the world. There is no confirmation that the girls have been freed. French officials say they hope the Fatah statement is true. They say they do not know what, if any, flight the girls may be aboard. Investigators looking into the Pan Am plane crash in Scotland have sent pieces of wreckage and a suitcase away for more detailed examination to find out if they support the theory of a mid-air bomb blast. The search for wreckage and bodies continued today in heavy rain and poor visibility. The BBC's Colin Blaine has more from Lockerbie.
Ever since Pan Am Flight 103 came down on Wednesday night, there's been intense speculation about whether the disaster was caused by a bomb on board the plane. Today's announcement by the Department of Transport that a suitcase and some pieces of wreckage are being sent for further examination by explosives experts suggests that important clues as to the cause of the crash may have been found. The department's spokeswoman in the Lockerbie operation is Penny Russell-Smith.
Some pieces of wreckage and a suitcase are today being taken to the Royal Armaments Research and Development Establishment at Fort Halsted in Kent for more detailed examination to determine whether they exhibit evidence of a pre-impact explosion.
The statement also makes it clear that structural failure hasn't been ruled out and that such a possibility is still being investigated. But the accident team haven't found any evidence of that so far.
The BBC's Colin Blaine in Lockerbie. In the aftermath of a prison riot in Mexico, there's evidence that five inmates died after being taken into custody by police. Officials say that all told, 25 people died in the two-day uprising. A videotape shot by an NBC News camera crew shows 13 prisoners flat on the ground being questioned by police. Five can be heard giving their names. Those names are on a list of the dead given out Saturday. A police spokesman was unable to explain how the deaths could have occurred. About 400 Haitians were headed home today after being intercepted by the Coast Guard in the Caribbean as they attempted to sail to the U.S. 287 Haitians aboard a 40-foot sailboat were picked up Saturday and more than 100 more yesterday. A Coast Guard spokesman says that the would-be refugees reported that several more boatloads are leaving Haiti. Haitians do not qualify for asylum in the U.S. because they are considered economic rather than political refugees. The day after Christmas was a white one in much of the plains and Midwest. A storm burying up to 12 inches of snow and wind chills as low as 45 degrees below zero moved through the region today, backing up air traffic just as holiday travelers were heading home. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says 1988 has been a very good year for the music, and he's painstakingly selected 10 albums, in no special order, that he says are the best of the year's releases. From one of the winners, here's singer Betty Carter.
In jazz, 1988 was the year of singer Betty Carter. Some of her old records got reissued, a set of duets with Carmen McRae came out, and she got a guest shot on The Cosby Show. But her latest album, called Look What I Got, is the real reason to cheer. No jazz singer is a better improviser, and Carter knows how to tease a lyric. At a time when much of the best jazz stems from imaginative writing, Betty Carter asserts the primacy of improvisation. This was also the year jazz lost the great arranger Gil Evans, who infused lush orchestral charts with blues feeling. A new release by Evans and singer Helen Merrill, called Collaboration, is a loose remake of an album they made together in 1956. Merrill's not in the greatest voice, and the album has some of Evans' more sugary music. But it was great to hear him revisit his own peak period, and Steve Lacy's soprano sax was a nice perk.
Sweetening water, cherry wall. You kindly, I'm feeling fine. Kansas City, Carolina, that's my honeycomb. And any place I hang my hands on.
...1988 continued a hot streak for alto saxophonist Ornette Coleman. Virgin Beauty is the most plaintive and controlled of the albums he's made with his electric band Prime Time. Also on a roll is saxophonist and composer Henry Threadgill. On the album Easily Slip Into Another World, his septet plays structurally complex music with roots in down-home blues and brass bands. As usual, independent labels produce some of the year's most adventurous jazz. One of 88's very best is Kids Mysteries by saxophonist Sean Bergen and his 10-piece band M.O.B. Bergen is an expatriate South African living in Amsterdam. His colorful, hard-swinging stuff is a witty mix of South African jazz, polkas, tangos, Charles Mingus, and French chamber music. One excerpt can't do him justice, but here's a bit of Sean Bergen's composition, Beach Balls. Bassist Michael Bizio's pianoless quartet on the album In Seattle hit a natural balance between straight-ahead swing and open ensemble textures, reinvigorating old forms. Alto saxophonist Tim Burns' quintet album, Sanctified Dreams, was designed like a patchwork quilt. If the individual pieces seemed disjointed at first, they all fit into a larger pattern. Critics loved it, but Columbia Records didn't. They dumped Burn a few months later. He's since resurfaced on the German label JMT. The flood of great jazz reissues continued in 1988. Picking only three for this list is absurd, but here goes. The most imposing reissue was the complete Charlie Parker on Verve, a 10-CD box set. The recordings from the 40s and 50s sound amazingly clean, and scholar Phil Schaap's extensive notes set the scene for each session. Yeah, it costs a fortune, but so do those library editions of the complete Herman Melville. Parker deserves the same sort of meticulous attention. Another CD reissue, called the RCA Victor Jazz Workshop, The Arrangers, has nice mid-50s charts by Gil Evans, George Russell, and Johnny Carisi, but the show's stolen by the unjustly obscure composer and trombonist Rod Levitt. His five mid-60s pieces mark him as an inspired talent who got away. My favorite reissue this year is Earl Hines Plays Duke Ellington, a two-hour set of early 70s solo music. Looking back at his own career as much as at Ellington's, the great Hines shows why he was jazz's first avant-garde pianist. Here's Earl Hines on Caravan. I regret being able to mention only a fraction of the albums that brought me pleasure this year, but I'm glad that jazz is in such great shape that these choices are so hard. As for my favorite bad album of 1988, it's got to be Hooked on Dixie, 44 nonstop Dixieland favorites by Joe Fingers Webster and his River City Jazzmen from KTEL.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. For a complete list of his 10 best, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to Fresh Air, WHYY, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. This is Fresh Air. The most enduring of all rock and roll Christmas records is the Phil Spector Christmas album, which was released in 1963 and was reissued last year on Rhino Records. The album features the girl group Spector produced singing Christmas songs. That's the Ronettes. Alan Betrock wrote a book on the girl groups. He described the Ronettes as the pinnacle of the girl group era, and he described their 1963 hit Be My Baby as the perfect pop record. Ronnie Spector was the lead singer of the Ronettes. She married her producer Phil Spector a few years after Be My Baby was released. At his insistence, she retired from the music business. After they divorced in the early 70s, Ronnie started to perform and record again. Her latest album featured new songs, but the record she's still best known for is this. Tonight. first hear this song? Did the songwriter sing it for you before you performed it the first time?
Well, the first time I heard it, you know, Phil and those were and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry. We met in a little studio, and they started writing around me. And I guess I was 16 years old and very shy, and I liked Phil at the time, and he liked me. I think they wrote it all around that. You know, our little love affair at the beginning. I think it was all a part of that.
Do you remember the recording session?
Like it was yesterday.
What was it like?
It was incredible, because there I was in California recording, and I'd never left New York. I'd never been out of New York in my whole life. And there I am on a plane going to California by myself without the other two Ronettes just to do the lead part. And I loved it. I love it till today. I still love it. I mean, it's just a record that I remember that day being in the studio. I remember what color dress I was wearing. I remember everything.
One of the things you do on this record is your famous, I can't even imitate this, but your famous "Whoa-oh."
Yes.
How did you come up with that? Was that something you just started singing?
No, it was like Frankie Lyman used to sing, "Why do birds sing so gay? And love is away with break of day. Why do they fall in love?" And so I sort of got it from him, and it was like my own little "ho-ho's" came out. And I think it's just something that I started, and it stuck.
You formed the Ronettes with two of your cousins when you were all teenagers.
No, a sister and a cousin.
A sister and a cousin, okay. And how did you learn to sing harmonies?
Actually, it was like a bunch of cousins. I had so many first cousins. It was like three other girls besides the two Ronettes, and it was a boy cousin singing lead, and it just sort of narrowed down to one. And I remember the three of us being on the rooftop, like learning routines, because we never had a choreographer or anything. We sort of did what the street dances and stuff, and we just made it three. It was a family, and we had a sort of strict upbringing. So we couldn't go out, and we could look out in the street and watch other girls walk and everything, but we couldn't go out. So we stayed in the house, and that's how we all just started singing.
You broke into the music business by being a dancer at the Peppermint Lounge, being a dancer on the Murray the K Show,
right.
Singing backup vocals. Did you do things in those early days to help get yourself noticed? Did you either like dress in such a way as to call attention to yourself? Okay, what'd you do?
First of all, we tried to. You have to have a gimmick in this business, we figured, and so we wore our hair extra high. You know, the beehives in the '60s, and we wore eyeliner. You know, like Chinese eyes almost, and we wore slits up the side of our dresses because we sang and danced. We had a lot of aunts. My mother has like six sisters, and so that's seven of them dressing us, and they told us to put a cigarette in our mouth. And we stood outside the Peppermint Lounge, dressed just alike. And I was so glad, because at 14 I was smoking. They just didn't know it. And it was great because we stood online, and we had to look older, so we had to exaggerate everything because all of us were underage.
Now, you know, it always made me think that you were really tough, really streetwise.
No.
Where, you know?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, when we heard about people being junkies or dope addicts, I would ask my mother, "Well, let me see one," because the way my family would talk about them, it was like it was a disease, because I was very young and I didn't know. So I wasn't a tough streetwise kid at all, but we just did all the dances, and I loved it. From the time I was 3 years old, when my whole family applauded me, I remember the song was "Jambalina Cove, Spine of Gilly Gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna meet my Shadow Mio. Pick a spot filled with Guy Handy Gale. Son of a gun, we're having fun on the bayou." And I think that's when I got my ho 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 ho. And then my family just started applauding me, and I was like 3 years old. And I said, that's what I want to be the rest of my life. I want to perform.
You gave up rock and roll for a while when you married Phil Spector.
That's not the right way to put it. I didn't give it up. As a matter of fact, I didn't know when I got married that I would never sing again. I thought, as a matter of fact, I would be recording a little bit more and maybe touring a little less.
So it was kind of against your will that you
started. Yeah, it was something I didn't expect.
Well, during that period, did you sing a lot in the house just to keep your voice in shape?
No, because there was no rock and roll allowed in my house then. It was only classical music played throughout the whole house, and how can I sing the classical music, you know, rock and roll? And I just didn't sing. I just, at night I would go to sleep, I remember, and just turn over and just think about being on stage and singing. Occasionally when I was in the bathroom, in the bathtub, I'd sing songs and stuff, but never too loud because he'd get angry.
Yeah, there was no rock and roll because your husband of the time, Phil Spector, didn't want it in the house. When you left that marriage and you left mm-hmm. him and you tried to re-enter the music business again, had you lost your bearings for a while? Was it hard for you to find your place? You'd been out of the scene for a while, mm-hmm. and you hadn't even been listening to the music for a while.
Right. No, but I never lost my bearing. It's like, I guess it's like riding a bicycle. Once you, you know, learn, once you fall off, you get right back on. And that's how I was with my singing. Of course, it was much tougher. I remember I came back in 74, and I went to Buddha Records, and they auditioned me. They loved me. And a few weeks later, Phil sent them a letter saying that I was still his wife, because it took me 2 years to get a divorce. And immediately they let me go. So I had a lot against me because of Phil. You know, people just said, well, we don't want to be bothered with him because he was known for suing people and, you know, making scenes and keeping people in court. And that's basically why I didn't get started as fast as I wanted to, you know.
You recently remarried, and I believe your husband is also your manager.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you were ever afraid to get involved with a professional relationship that was also an intimate relationship because of how you had been hurt the first time.
Well,
by combining the two. Like
I tell you, I wouldn't have gotten married to this gentleman if I had known. I made sure, because
right.
of my first marriage, I made sure, because he was managing other people in Broadway shows and stuff. So he knew that I loved it, and I knew he loved what he was doing. And I knew that he loved me being on stage. He loved it because I loved it. And I don't think I would have ever gotten married to a man that didn't like my career or didn't have anything to do with it or just didn't want me on stage.
To my knowledge, you're the only one of the Ronettes that is still singing. What are your sister and cousin doing now?
They're both married to the same guys for like 19, 20 years, and they have kids. See, when we were younger as the Ronettes, I always loved it, and they liked it. We were having fun, you know, making all this money, young and having fun, and they liked it a lot until they met the men they were going to marry. And I loved it. See, there's a difference. They liked it, and I loved it.
Singer Ronnie Spector. Her latest album, Unfinished Business, was released last year, and Phil Spector's A Christmas Gift for You has been reissued on Rhino Records.
Just see those sleigh bells jingle and ring, tingle, tingling too.
Ring-a-ling-a-ling-ding.
Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Outside the snow is falling and friends are calling you.
Ring-a-ling-a-ling-ding.
Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.
This is Fresh Air.
This is NPR's Robert Siegel. Later on All Things Considered, we'll be hearing from Lockerbie, Scotland, where the search through the wreckage of the crash of Pan Am Flight 103 continues. Still, no evidence to prove either a bomb on board or a structural defect that might have caused the crash. Also, news that the Abu Nidal organization, the breakaway Palestinian group, says it's releasing two hostages in the Middle East, two young French girls. And we'll be hearing also from Hélène Tremblay, a French-Canadian journalist who's written Families of the World, a look at family life throughout the Western Hemisphere. We'll also be hearing audio snapshots, the records that people used to record in the 40s and 30s and send to their loved ones at holiday time. That's later today on All Things Considered from NPR.
This Sunday night, CBS is premiering a made-for-TV movie that might strike you as an odd choice to launch the new year. It's based on the true story of a pop star's rise and early death. David Bianculli has this review.
Talking to myself and feeling old. Sometimes I'd like to quit. Nothing ever seems to fit. Hanging around. Nothing to do but frown. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down.
That's one of 12 top 10 songs by the Carpenters, a brother-sister act that had a number one single with their first record, Close to You, in 1970. Hit after hit followed until 1975, when their career started to go downhill. And in 1983, when Karen Carpenter died, the act was through. That doesn't sound like the makings of a very dramatic biography, but a lot more has been done with a lot less. La Bamba, for example. But the real reason the story of the Carpenters is being told for television is that Karen Carpenter was the first famous person to die of complications from anorexia nervosa. Because it's a serious subject, yet deals with celebrity biography, CBS is proudly presenting the Karen Carpenter story this Sunday as its first made-for-TV movie of 1989. If done correctly, it could have been pretty good, but it isn't. The show's executive producer is Richard Carpenter, the brother half of the act, so you know automatically that the honesty isn't going to cut too deeply. And though Cynthia Gibb and Mitchell Anderson look and act like the Carpenters, the Karen Carpenter story doesn't really explain much, especially about their music. Oh, it shows how they became a team and says how they never made a mistake in the recording studio. It tells how Richard's ears perked up when he heard "We've Only Just Begun" played on a late-night TV ad for a local bank. He ran out and bought the rights so the Carpenters could record it, and within a year, they were international celebrities. And, as this movie presents it, the world was overcome by a wave of Carpenter mania.
I love you, Karen!
But we're alone now, and I'm singing this song for you.
But let's be serious here. Not once in the telemovie is there any indication of who writes the lyrics, or if they all came from bank commercials. And musically, the Carpenters were purely a pop act, and, if not for the backstage drama and trauma, deserve a telemovie biography about as much as Tony Orlando and Dawn. The focus of Barry Morrow's script is the growing insecurity of the Carpenter siblings. Richard starts popping Quaaludes and Karen stops eating. The reason? Well, according to the Karen Carpenter story, a lot of it's due to their mother, who's played in this drama by Louise Fletcher. She's concerned when their children start falling apart, but doesn't recognize that her domineering attitude is part of the problem.
If I just listen to you, then everything is going to work out for the best.
Is that so wrong, wanting what's best for my children?
Not always what's best for me.
I know that everybody has problems. Your father and I have had many, many...
Spare me the speech I've heard a zillion times. Just stay out of my personal life. You are smothering me. I know that you mean well, and I love you for it, but you have got to let me live my own life. You have just got to.
Another reason given for Karen's anorexia is that, in her first review in Billboard, some nasty critic referred to her as Richard's chubby sister. So there's no way I'm going to be nasty to Cynthia Gibb, who plays Karen. If anyone out there wants to watch her do a raging bull in reverse and get thinner by the minute, be my guest.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
That is why all the girls in town follow you all around. Just like me.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, singer and songwriter Amy Mann talks about her band Till Tuesday. Most of the songs on her new album are about her breakup with songwriter Jules Shear. Rock critic Ken Tucker said it could have been an embarrassing exposé. Instead, it's a pleasing balance between autobiography and art. Also, rock historian Ed Ward has some thoughts on how rock and roll history is being passed on to new rock listeners. And John Leonard has a review of a new book by Ward Just. He's a former Washington Post reporter who now writes political novels. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Joyce Lieberman, RG Vobleidis, and Richard Parker are our engineers. Chris Burden directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.